Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, June 24, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group telephone conference call. On today's call, we're going to be discussing the just-decided Fisher v. University of Texas at Austin case, in which the Supreme Court revisited the use of affirmative action in college admissions. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. I am pleased to welcome to our call today two experts, Mr. Peter Kersenow and Professor Gail Harriet. We're going to hear opening remarks from Mr. Kersenow, some commentary perhaps by Professor Harriet, or in any event, she'll be available to answer questions from the audience. Peter Kersenow is a partner with the Benesch, Friedlander, Copeland, and Aronoff law firm, where he is in their labor and employment practice group and a member of the Diversity and Inclusion Committee. He's a current member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and former member of the National Labor Relations Board in Washington, D.C. Professor Gail Harriet is a professor at the University of San Diego Law School, where she teaches and writes in the area of civil rights, employment discrimination, product liability, remedies, and torts. She's a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights as well, and formerly served as civil rights counsel to the U.S. Senate Committee on the Judiciary. Both Mr. Kersenow and Professor Harriet are speaking in their personal capacities here today. And with that, Mr. Kersenow, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks very much, Dean, and good afternoon to everybody. With respect to Fisher versus Texas, I think there had been some anticipation on the part of those who aren't necessarily inclined to support the current racial preference regime in college admissions that there would be some type of profound determination by the court. And there may have been a little bit of a concern that there would be a determination by the court on those who generally favor the current use of racial preferences in college admissions to achieve diversity, that their court's decision might have some significant impact that could severely curtail the use of racial admissions in the collegiate ranks and also in the law school and medical school ranks. I think that the decision of the court, while not something that had overturned the use of racial preferences, has placed some guardrails around the use of preferences in college admissions. And those guardrails, I don't think can be, should be understated. At least my initial read of this was one where I said, well, this is not something that is particularly earth-shattering. But on a closer read, I think that the court's the parameters established by the court with respect to the use of racial admissions are those that in practice may make it a little bit more difficult to use the racial preferences in the manner in which they're currently being used by some universities. Now, keep in mind, as I think everybody on this call probably understands, that any type of racial classification, the use of such racial classification by a public entity has got to pass strict scrutiny, and that may be one of the highest standards in our jurisprudence to achieve, and it has two components to it. The first is that use of it must serve a compelling state interest. That's a very high standard. Prior to the Bakke, Grutter, and Gratz decisions, the only things that would qualify as compelling state interests were matters pertaining to national security and law enforcement and the remediation of actual instances of past discrimination. The second prong to the strict scrutiny standard is once you have established that what you're doing is a compelling state interest, it must nonetheless be narrowly tailored to serve that interest. And what the Fisher case did here is to narrow or clarify what it is that a university may do in terms of serving the compelling state interest. That is, the narrow tailoring prong is, at least in the court's wording, not entitled to any deference. The university is not entitled to any deference whatsoever by the court. And that's fairly significant. Let me, however, go back to the first prong, and that is the compelling state interest prong. There, when we saw the Supreme Court last visit this issue, it said that, well, we're going to grant universities deference in their judgment as to whether diversity is essential to their educational mission. And it did so on a First Amendment theory that flowed from Sweezy versus New Hampshire, which is a Supreme Court case from several decades earlier. And so the court said in the Grutter case, we're going to give universities a degree of deference in determining what their educational mission is. And if diversity is part of that educational mission, then we're going to defer to that determination. In this case, they say again that we will give, meaning the Supreme Court, courts generally, will give some deference to educational institutions of higher learning to define their mission in a way that says diversity is essential thereto. But again, we're not going to give any deference to how you accomplish that goal of diversity. And one of the reasons why I think that on my second read of this, that may be a little bit more significant than I originally thought is when you take a look at what universities are doing in practice, we have got at least some evidence that universities in crafting their racial admissions programs are not necessarily doing it as narrowly as one might hope. In the case of the University of Texas, they had already, to some extent, achieved diversity. In fact, they had a public pronouncement on behalf of the university that indicated that by using a race-neutral mechanism, they had significantly increased their diversity. Yet nonetheless, after Grutter was passed, or Grutter was decided, they then resorted to a racial preference regime that did take race specifically into account, despite the fact that they'd already achieved a measure of diversity. Now, we'll see what happens when the thing is remanded, but that implicates whether or not they are narrowly crafting the mechanism by which they achieve diversity if they've already achieved diversity before even implementing this new program. And that goes back again to prong number one, the extent to which a court's going to defer to their judgment on this. So with respect to prong number two, if universities continue to implement race-neutral programs where it is very broad, where it's more than simply a flexible or race is simply more than a flexible plus factor, where the racial preference program is not time limited, where the racial preference program is implemented without an examination by the university as to whether or not there has been some workable race-neutral alternative that has been at least considered, then courts, at least the Supreme Court says courts, should look very skeptically as to whether or not the university has satisfied prong number two, the narrow tailoring prong. And I think I'll stop at that point right there. I'll let Gail add anything she would like to add to this. But I would say that there's a lot to discuss when it comes to prong number two. Easily, those who had thought that maybe Fisher could be a vehicle to cabin prong number one may have been a little disappointed by this, but prong number two has been circumscribed to a point where it's no longer something where universities can simply say, here's how we're going to do it, and courts are going to have to kind of accept that or defer to that. Now it's going to be something that's going to require a little bit more effort on the part of universities.
Professor Harriet, do you want to weigh in here, or would you prefer to go right to the audience for questions?
I think I'd like to comment a little bit on some of the other opinions. One of the things that was interesting about this case was that it was a 7-1 opinion, with Ginsburg being the only dissenter. Kagan was recused. So that means that Breyer and Sotomayor were part of the majority. But the opinion that I love to read is Justice Thomas's opinion. Justice Thomas points out in his concurrence that the evidence continues to mount that race preferential admissions are doing more harm than good, even for their intended beneficiaries. So if you look at this evidence, if this evidence is correct, and at this point it's becoming very difficult to deny this evidence, it means that we have fewer African-American physicians, fewer scientists, fewer African-American engineers, lawyers, college professors, than we would have had we been using race-neutral policies. So as well-meaning as affirmative action policies were originally, they've backfired badly. And at some point, colleges and universities and the courts are going to have to come to terms with that. Now, one could say, look, you know, that really shouldn't influence a decision of the Supreme Court of the United States. And I have to say, that's right, it shouldn't. Just like the Supreme Court was criticized back in the 1950s with Brown versus the Board of Education. They were criticized for making the opinion appear to hinge on the Dahl experiments that showed that black children attending segregated schools preferred white dolls to black dolls, and that this was thought to be evidence of the harm of segregation. It shouldn't have mattered what black children in the South in the 1950s thought of dolls. That, you know, that Brown versus the Board of Education should have come out the same way regardless. And in my opinion, Grutter should have come out the same way regardless. But as Thomas points out, you know, underlying the original Grutter decision was the assumption, it wasn't even good science, just the assumption that this is having a good effect on minority students. And it turns out it's not. So I think it's a very good thing that Justice Thomas has discussed this in his concurrence. I hope it receives a lot of publicity. I hope a lot of people look at it thoughtfully because I think it's important. Scalia's point was simply in his concurrence that the issue of whether to overturn Grutter was just not on the table, that during the oral argument the attorney for the plaintiff had basically said, look, we're not seeking to overturn Grutter. We believe that Grutter properly construed wouldn't cover this case. And so we didn't get the big blockbuster decision that some people wanted. But I think that nevertheless, this opinion moves in the direction of putting limits on racially preferential admissions policies. And we can expect that there will be more lawsuits. Maybe even this very lawsuit will return to the Supreme Court after remand, and that we may see further cutting back or at least clarifying the decision of the court in 2003 in Grutter versus Bollinger. But after that, I think let's take questions.
All right. We've got over 200 people on the call, so let's see what's on their minds. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, you'll need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we turn to the audience, let me make a reminder for folks that the next decision day for the Supreme Court is tomorrow. It's quite likely we're going to have additional Teleforum conference calls yet to be scheduled tomorrow and then in the days after. So do check in on the Federal Society website and keep track of your emails. Be alert for calls as they're scheduled. Also, since we've got so many people on the call today, I expect a number of questions. This is a hot topic. I'm going to ask our callers to be as concise as possible with their questions. And with that, let's go to our first caller.
Hi, Ilya Soman, George Mason University. I think both of you seem to agree that the decision makes it tougher for schools to enact explicitly race-conscious admissions policies, but the decision also says, well, you have to consider race-neutral alternatives. So the big question is, what counts as a race-neutral alternative? For instance, whether the Texas 10% plan, which is a part of the UT admission system, qualifies or not. When you look at traditional racial discrimination where state and local governments used facially neutral policies for the purpose of discriminating against blacks, the court has said that that's not constitutional, but the question arises whether a similar standard will be applied to programs that try to do the same thing to benefit minorities. So I wonder if I could get your thoughts on what would qualify as a genuinely race-neutral program and whether the 10% plan is one.
Yeah, I will tell you, this is my own personal opinion, that when you've got what appears to be with the 10% plan, a facially neutral alternative that was explicitly created to have a racial effect, I don't think, at least based on the wording of this particular decision, that they're going to be necessarily receptive to this being a race-neutral alternative. I think what was happening here was, in Texas, they came up with a 10% plan to increase very robustly and explicitly the number of blacks and Hispanics in the UT system. And given that, the court has said no deference anymore to this. We're not going to give you any type of deference to this. If they're going to hew to what they've stated in this decision, it's going to be a tough push to say that this somehow is a race-neutral alternative.
Professor Harriet, do you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I think I'd like to. I think Professor Soman has raised a significant question here, but it's complex. On the one hand, I think there's no doubt in the world that when the Texas legislature passed the law requiring the Texas percent solution, they were thinking in terms, at least some of them were thinking in terms of racial, getting racial diversity through this method. What happened was there was an earlier case in the Fifth Circuit, Hopwood versus the University of Texas, was pre-Grutter, and the Hopwood decision was that racial preferences were unconstitutional, and therefore the Texas legislature scrambled to fill what they perceived as a void. But it seems to me that if the intent is solely to create racial diversity, that's what they're after, then one could argue that it is just as unconstitutional as other forms of racial discrimination. I mean, you could argue that if it's done at the wholesale level, it's still with the intent to advantage one group over another. The trouble with that is that I'm not really sure that it is wholly intended simply to create racial diversity. I think that was the triggering issue. But what's interesting, if you look at California, right after Prop 209 was passed, Ward Connerly was the University of California regent who had gotten the ball rolling on Prop 209, which was an initiative here that banned race discrimination and racial preferences in admissions, among other things. But Ward Connerly voted in favor of the plan. I think it's a 6% plan, or maybe it's 4% here in California. It's not a 10% plan here, but he voted in favor of it, not because he was trying to achieve race discrimination. Rather, he thought that it would be a good thing in terms of socioeconomic diversity, which he favored. And it may well be that many of the people in Texas saw the Hopwood as the triggering agent for the 10% solution. But it's not quite as clear that they saw it merely in terms of race. They may have seen it more broadly. So it becomes kind of a difficult question. And obviously Ginsburg is quite convinced that the 10% solution is only as constitutionally unobjectionable as more direct preferences would be. But I think it's actually a pretty complex issue.
It is complex. If you look at whether or not the objective is a malign one or a benign one, personally, I don't know that there's much of a distinction. If you go back to Griggs versus Duke Power and you've got a facially neutral policy that has been implemented to have a malign intent and the impact has a racially discriminatory impact, here the objective is purportedly benign, yet it has a racially discriminatory effect. It is being done for a racial intent. I think that it's going to be complex, but I think it's something that raises an issue that litigants in the future are going to have to address.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that Ms. Fisher's counsel didn't want to raise it. I mean, they wanted to look at the issue, the smaller program that was added on top of the 10% program. So they did not address it, and I think that was wise of them.
Once again, if you have a question for our experts, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hello, this is Kurt Levy at the Committee for Justice. My question for both of you is, do you think this decision will be, in a sense, like Northwest Austin was to voting rights? And of course, I'm assuming that Shelby County will strike a blow to Section 5, the preclearance requirement. It almost seems like, if you remember in Northwest Austin, I can't remember if it was unanimous or close to unanimous, but the court was basically saying, okay, we really mean that we want you to make changes here. We'll give you one more chance. That's sort of how I read this. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, I guess first of all, you don't want to count your chickens before they hatch on Shelby County. But second, I would say that in Northwest Austin, the court was much more explicit that they were on the verge of finding the preclearance provisions a violation of the Constitution. So I think they're far less explicit here. I think this is going to be a long process that may involve many cases. And so I would say that it's not that close to the Northwest Austin situation.
Yeah, I don't disagree with Gail, although I would say that the posture of this case gave them an easy out if they wanted one and they took it. Yet, nonetheless, I think they have given a little bit greater guidance now to litigants, at least with respect to plaintiffs who are challenging racially discriminatory programs, because if you go back to Grutter and Gratz and all of the evidence that we have found since then related to how these programs are administered, the narrow tailoring prong could very well be a very difficult one for college admissions programs to defend now. If there's no deference to which they're entitled, they're going to have to explain, meaning these colleges, how it is, if this is a flexible plus factor, that is, that race is only one of a host of factors that are being considered in the admissions process, how is it that in practice race becomes the overriding, the dominant factor, where in a number of college admissions programs, non-preferred candidates are at a deficit of sometimes 10, 30, 100 times to one in terms of the probabilities of admission over similarly situated preferred candidate. So I think that when this type of evidence is adduced, it's going to be an uphill challenge for some of these programs.
Let's go to another caller. Hold on.
Hi, this is Evan Bullock in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm an attorney here. A bit of a compound question. First, now that even the liberals seem to have pretty much agreed that strict scrutiny must be applied to these kind of things, what do you think the chances are that the Fifth Circuit will rule the same way on remand? And secondly, should we take, assuming this gets back to the Supreme Court, should we take this as a meaning that Kennedy, the swing vote, does not have the appetite for overturning Grutter, but would rather maintain just strict scrutiny?
I'm going to have to defer to Gail because Gail knows that I am an inveterate optimist when it comes to these things. I always see the silver lining on these, and I'm really hopeful that the next time it goes back to the Supreme Court that the whole regime gets overturned. And but I don't know what we can read into Kennedy's decision. I do know that if you look at what Kennedy's written in the past, back in 2003, he has written things that would suggest that he doesn't have a great appetite for racial preferences. And given the right case with the right posture, and this was not that. I mean, this was something that was on summary judgment. He might decide he's going to go against racial preferences in their entirety. But, Gail, you're more sober on these things. I'll defer to you.
Well, sometimes I'm just the pessimist to go with your optimist. So I don't want to lean too far in the other direction. While I don't see a pony here, I don't see a pile of something ugly either. So what will happen when this case is remanded? I really don't know. I hope that Ms. Fisher's counsel will make a strong case that this program is not narrowly tailored to achieve the compelling purpose of diversity. But if the Fifth Circuit simply turns around and issues the same view, that just means it's going to get up to the Supreme Court again that much faster. So I'm not certain that necessarily would be terrible to lose in the Fifth Circuit. Is Kennedy is he too weak-willed for this? I don't think so. I actually think Kennedy's pretty good on these issues. He's by temperament not someone that likes blockbuster opinions, but I think that he's pretty reliable on this issue. So I don't worry about him.
Yeah. Hey, Kurt, I think there's a tendency by some of us to take a look at the two prongs of strict scrutiny, and I'll just speak for myself. We focus on prong number one, compelling state interest, and many of us believe that, well, if making sure that we have enough Black and Hispanic students in a pottery class is a compelling state interest, then anything's a compelling state interest. I will admit for the last 10 years I've been focused probably unduly on the first prong. And maybe that's a mistake because we have seen that there's a lot of evidence that very few of these universities can do what they are attempting to do and satisfy what the Supreme Court today has articulated as the parameters of the second prong. I just think it's going to be very, very difficult for them to justify most of their programs as being narrowly tailored.
By the way, I hope that Ms. Fisher's counsel won't give up on the old standard, and that is good faith. The court has made it clear that good faith is not the standard, but I'm not even certain that if the proper evidence is presented, that the university even could have lived up to that standard, in the sense that there's a lot of talk about diversity being a compelling purpose, but that doesn't actually mean that it's the University of Texas's purpose. The University of Texas seemed instead concerned about basically racial balancing, having a racial composition of the class that reflects the demographics of the state of Texas. That appears to be what they are after, and not the educational benefits that might be reaped from having racial diversity. So I hope that on remand that point will be made. The court didn't, this circuit didn't buy it earlier, but I don't think the point was actually supported by evidence, and I think there's a lot of evidence out there. Many college administrators and academics have confessed in writing that diversity is not really what it's all about, and that's not really what they're trying to do, that there may or may not be educational benefits to diversity, but what they're really concerned about is remedying past discrimination by society in general. And if they wander into that area, if that's the real purpose of these programs, then they are unconstitutional going back as far as Bakke. So I hope that argument is made below.
If you have a question for either of our experts, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to join the queue. It looks like we've got two questions pending at this point. Then our lines will be open. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Bob Fitzpatrick in Washington, D.C. I have a two-part question in terms of how this might translate into the employment sector. First part, what impact might this have on OFCCP's affirmative action programs? For example, its most recent program essentially requiring, I think it's 7 or 9% of the workforce of contractors be disabled. And secondly, how might this translate into private and public sector non-OFCCP mandated affirmative action programs?
Yeah, those are good questions. I'll take a stab at it. I've taken a little bit of a look at this with respect to the OFCCP issue. As you know, in the employment context, employers have less latitude than the courts granted to educational institutions. And going back to something that Gail talked about, remediation of societal discrimination, that's not going to get it done. We've got Johnson versus Transportation Agency. We've got a couple of other decisions, Steelworkers versus Weber, that define kind of the outer parameters as to what employers are permitted to do in terms of affirmative action programs, voluntary affirmative action programs, where they have not yet been adjudged to have had a manifestly unbalanced workforce, for example, or have been engaged in past instances of discrimination. The OFCCP issue is very interesting because what we've got there is an attempt by the OFCCP to mandate that contractors, federal contractors, provide preferences or engage in affirmative action when it comes to getting your numbers right related to the number of disabled workers in your workforce. A number of employers are still struggling with that for a number of reasons. As you might imagine, under the Americans with Disabilities Act, Bob, you know that you're not permitted to make inquiry as to the status of somebody until a provisional offer of employment has already been made. So a number of contractors have posed the question, how is it that we arrive at our numbers without running afoul of the Americans with Disabilities Act? And the OFCCP comes up with an answer that I don't know would be satisfactory to most who want to avoid litigation. They pretty much say, trust us. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but that's kind of their response. And also there's an issue because the correlative to that is the OFCCP's attempt to enshrine the Paycheck Fairness Act when it was already rejected a couple of times by Congress. So there's that issue. But I guess the bottom line with respect to the Fisher case, universities are given a deference in prong one that aren't afforded to employers. So employers looking at this, I'm not sure that they can glean much out of this other than to say, you know what, the current composition of the Supreme Court isn't necessarily very friendly to the idea of affirmative action, because in this case, at least, they've cabined it a little bit more.
Professor Harriet, did you want to weigh in on this point?
I think that Pete has said things that I learned from, so I don't need to.
Okay, terrific. Let's go to the next caller then.
Hello, this is Arthur Hellman. I'd like to follow up on the references to Justice Ginsburg's dissenting opinion, her lone dissent, which, echoing some stuff that Justice Souter had said and Grutter, said essentially, look, all you're doing here is requiring the universities to camouflage what they're doing a little better, to pretend they're doing something else, and that will end up satisfying the standard. I wonder if you'd comment on that thought of Justice Ginsburg's.
The only comment I have is, and I said this when Grutter and Gratz came out, is Justice Ginsburg is at least an honest liberal. I mean, she had a very, very honest assessment of this. She said, look, we know what we're doing here. Let's be honest about it. But other than that, I really don't have any comment.
I don't want to repeat what I said about the percent plans. But let me just comment that, you know, this issue was also an issue in Grutter and Gratz. I mean, you can look at that pair of cases as simply a holding by the court that you can engage in racial preferences as long as you camouflage it. And, you know, she wasn't keen on that then, and she's not keen on it now.
Again, don't you think universities are so committed to what has already been mentioned, basically racial balancing, they'll find some way of doing it, whatever the rules are?
I think they will. I think they're going to work very hard to find a way to do it. And the question is, there are several questions. First, are they making a bet that in their various districts or circuits, there's not going to be a financed plaintiff who will take them on? Because even if, in this case, the Supreme Court has made affirmative action a little bit more difficult to engage in on the part of universities, you first got to get a plaintiff, and you got to get a plaintiff who's going to have the resources to take this stuff up. And I think Gail alluded to this in her opening. Finding somebody, look, how many times have we found someone like that in the 10 years since Grutter? It doesn't happen that often, and it's not an easy proposition. I do think that even if you find a plaintiff, in a well-financed plaintiff, universities are still going to do this because I believe that, heck, that's the environment in academia. They think that this is the right thing to do. They're going to do this enthusiastically and robustly. I do think, though, that there's a great deal of peril on their part in doing this because now, as Gail indicated before, we have some evidence, and although it may not necessarily be evidence that the court's going to consider that these things actually harm the intended beneficiaries, we do have that evidence. But more importantly now, we've got the Supreme Court saying now two things. One is, with respect to prong one, we're going to give you some deference. Yeah, that's not really anything different from what they said in Grutter and Gratz, but there's some utility to having that repeated. And number two is, prong two is not separate from but is tethered to prong one. And prong two says you get no deference. So you can't simply just throw something up against the wall now and expect it to stick. You can't come up with some plan and try to make us feel good about the fact that this is narrowly tailored. We are going to closely examine whether or not this is narrowly tailored. That gives a degree of latitude to prospective plaintiffs because there is a ton of evidence out there that nothing that these universities are doing right now is narrowly tailored. They're just laughing all the way to the affirmative action bank, knowing that they can put anything, almost anything they want to, on paper, and no one's going to challenge it, no longer.
You know, we've had some experience with this in California, where the law is Proposition 209, where the universities cannot discriminate on the basis of race, sex, or ethnicity. And in truth, yeah, sure, the University of California does what it can to avoid Prop 209. It comes up with very complex ways to give special preferences for people in ways that are related to race but aren't race. But it's hard. It's not easy to do. They've got their percent plan. They've got a number of layers of special preferences that are purportedly for socioeconomic class, but nevertheless are connected to race. But what we're finding here is when you have to play, when you have to at least appear to be playing by the rules and not discriminating on the basis of race, it's a lot more awkward to come up with it. And as a result, the mismatch effect is much less here in California because they aren't able to come up with ways that comply with the initiative and do what they otherwise would like to do.
Going back to prong one again, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I do think this is important. When the court says, again, that universities are entitled to some deference with respect to whether or not this is a compelling state interest. That is, that the judgment of a college that diversity is essential to its educational mission. Now, remember in Grutter, the benefits that purportedly flow from a diverse student body were almost laughable and really weren't litigated. We are talking about the benefits are preparing students for a global marketplace, breaking down racial stereotypes, encouraging more robust classroom discussions. Those are also amorphous in general that I think that they're subject to attack. They're subject to being dismantled by a shrewd litigant. When you say, adduce that, show me how these things are essential to your mission, and show me, more importantly, how it is that reaching this magical critical mass, which no one, I mean, this is a formula. Critical mass is a formula more closely guarded than was the Manhattan Project. Tell me precisely how it is that having six black students as opposed to three in your physics class now all of a sudden breaks down a racial stereotype, encourages classroom discussion, and what is that racial stereotype? Is there a black speed of light versus an Asian speed of light? These are the kind of things that you may say, well, you know, let's examine a little bit closely now. Because now, as I said earlier, there is some benefit to having a Supreme Court say essentially the same thing it did before, because it highlights what the meaning was the first time, especially when it's tethered to prong number two.
Pete's point on physics classes, I think, relates back to mismatch, too. One of the arguments that the University of Texas made in this case was that even though they have a lot of racial diversity in some of their departments, they need more racial preferences so that they will have more minority students, so that they will have more diversity in their science and engineering departments as well. But the odd thing, of course, is that what happens instead is the opposite. The greater the preferences, the fewer minority students you will have in the science and engineering classes, because as some research has now demonstrated pretty thoroughly, what happens is that the science and engineering classes, the people who enter school, the minority students who enter school intending to major in science and engineering, end up majoring in something else instead if their entering credentials put them towards the bottom of the class. They massively opt out of science and engineering courses.
And these universities begin to wander into a catch-22 when they start to embark on the critical mass project of having a certain complexion of students within, say, a physics class or biology class, because at that point you start to run afoul of the prohibition against racial balancing. And Texas did that to some extent here, where originally they started arguing, well, you know, we need more students, more black students in given departments or classes versus in the university as a whole. So, you know, you can't have it both ways. You want to reach a certain critical mass, but in so doing, you may hit the tripwire of engaging in the verboten racial balancing.
All right, we've still got a couple questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Larry Purdy. I know Gail, and I was one of the lawyers in the Grutter and Gratz, so I read this case with this opinion today with fascination. I don't know. First, I think Justice Kennedy kind of made up a little bit when he said what was decided in Grutter, when he talked about that the court concluded that it was not a quota, was sufficiently flexible, limited in time, and followed serious good faith consideration of workable race-neutral alternatives. I can tell you there was zero evidence in Grutter of the University of Michigan considering a race-neutral alternative. And, of course, the trial court in Grutter found that, in fact, the policy was indistinguishable from a quota. So in order to consider these questions, how does the Fifth Circuit do this based on these are summary judgment motions. Doesn't this require that the Fifth Circuit take it and remand it back to the trial court for a full trial?
Hey, Larry, that's a very good question, because when I first read this, given the posture of the case, I thought to myself, how do they do this? If it's on summary judgments, they only have what they've got. Genuine issues to material fact, entitled to judgment as a matter of law, but the court implicitly says, well, we got to find out. We have to dig a little bit deeper to see whether or not it's narrowly tailored. It seems to me more evidence needs to be adduced. I don't know, Gail, do you have an opinion as to that?
I was actually surprised they didn't just remand it down to the trial court, but I don't really, I'm not that familiar with exactly what the record looks like. I mean, some summary judgment motions have almost no evidence. Others have quite a lot. So I don't really know whether the university is going to stand on what it has provided already or whether it's going to want to have a full-fledged trial.
Well, how? I mean, just for example, given the arguments made by counsel for Fisher, I can't believe that they would have conceded that there had been serious good faith consideration of workable race neutral alternatives that wouldn't have achieved whatever diversity they were seeking. And I just don't see how this opinion can be followed by the Fifth Circuit. If I were the Fifth Circuit, I'd be saying, this is going back to Judge Sparks or whoever the judge was, because we got to have a trial to determine whether these various factors have been met. And I will tell you that the problem I see is that in Grutter, all of these things, none of these things were met. That wasn't part of the trial. But now, supposedly, these things are going to be part of the consideration. So I was just curious what your thoughts were on that. I don't see how this can possibly be resolved without going back to the trial court for a full-blown hearing.
I actually think, you know, I'd have to think about this a little bit more, obviously, and take a look at all of the pleadings, but I actually think that would be a good thing. I'd love to see all the evidence adduced as to this, because I agree with you with respect to Grutter and Grotz. There were these summary statements made in those cases that didn't comport one jot and tittle with what the actual evidence was. There was nothing there to support. For example, in the Hallowed Law School case where they say this, well, as opposed to the undergrad where you had a raw point total with respect to grade point and SATs, the law school admissions process, which was much more holistic, it was an individualized review where race was nothing more than a flexible plus factor. And I said to myself, in looking through all of the underlying documentation, where do they get that from? Because among other things, what you see is, even though it's a supposed flexible plus factor, there are no rigid quotas, no assignments of raw point totals, curiously, somehow, the law school nonetheless arrived every year at almost the same percentages as it originally sought in its goals. How does that happen? Through some alchemy? Somewhere in that process, they had an assigned percentage that they sought to achieve that would not have been narrow tailoring, that would have been violative even of Grutter. And nonetheless, the court said, well, we're going to defer to them. This is how they did it. That's fine.
You know what this reminds me of is the old Brown versus the Board of Education to Broider versus Gale sequence, where if you read Brown and they talk about how under the Dahl experiments that students, you know, black students in segregated schools were being hurt, and you could tell this from the way they were responding to the Dahl experiments. And they talked about the importance of education, and it was a very case-specific kind of analysis was focused on education in particular. And, you know, you read that case and you figure, okay, this doesn't mean separate but equal is dead. It just means it's dead in elementary schools. And so there are all these other contexts you'd have to consider. And then by the time the court a few years later gets to Broider versus Gale, which was about segregated bus systems, it was a one-line opinion. They just said, you know, reversed as per Brown. And, of course, if you look back at Brown didn't say anything about segregated buses. It talked about education. But I think the court had learned, look, we really cannot deal with these fact issues. We cannot deal with these policy issues. It's just too big. It's too sprawling. You know, if we're going to have a rule, the rule is going to be no segregation, the end, no separate but equal. And maybe at some point the court will have to deal with enough sprawling and unmanageable cases to where they will again realize the virtue of rules against race discrimination that are simply hard and fast.
One reason why I think it would be at least for me, I would love to see these facts actually tried at a district court level, is because I don't think many universities could withstand that scrutiny. And as Larry just indicated with respect to Grutter, and in this case, very often the court has made these kind of totemic statements, these summary statements that are unhinged from the facts in the case. If you go to the records, and what we've seen, for example, the sometimes maligned studies that we've seen from a variety of sources, but I'll cite one that I really like because I haven't seen anybody challenge them with any degree of rectitude, and that is CEO studies with respect to the probabilities of comparatives from the preferred groups versus the non-preferred groups being admitted pursuant to a given university's admissions programs, and where preferred applicants are wildly more likely to be admitted over their similarly situated non-preferred comparatives. If you introduce evidence like that, it's going to be very difficult for a university to say that their program is narrowly tailored. If it's so narrowly tailored, if race under the Grutter standard is part of a holistic review where it's only a flexible plus factor, just one item among many, why is it that in practice that race is the dominant factor? In fact, it just completely overshadows every other factor. I'll give you an example is, and Larry, you may remember this, but in Grutter, actually in Graz, my recollection is that the factor of race was the functional equivalent of adding a full point to the preferred applicant's GPA score. It was the functional equivalent of having a perfect SAT score. That's how much race vaulted a preferred applicant over a non-preferred applicant. And I don't know this, but if you look at some of the extant data from universities where we can deduce some of this data, it looks like so many universities use race as a dominant factor that it would be very difficult to qualify under this Fisher standard where no difference is permitted.
All right, we've got one audience member question pending. Before we go to that, let me ask you, Peter Kirsten, or Professor Harriet, has the court, you keep alluding to how difficult it will be for universities to pass this test, has the court perhaps deliberately set a bar that the universities can't reach? Is this a two-step process for getting rid of affirmative action? And I guess that's the first half of my question. The second half is, what do you make of the delay? The court really can't take any longer in reaching a decision. This case was argued the second week and decided the final week of the term. And the fact that it came out 7-1. Is there anything that you read in here or think about that makes you think there might have been a smaller majority for more decisive action, 5-3?
If I had to guess, I would say that this decision is very different from what was planned at some point because it's really very short. And it's remarkable that it would have taken as long as it did to draft the opinion that is now the majority opinion. Justice Thomas's concurrence is a little longer, but this is a labor of love for him, and I'm sure he could have turned that out more quickly than he did. So there has to have been some negotiations at some point that I think caused the opinion to emerge the way it did. You know, we'll never know, or at least we'll probably never know exactly, you know, what went on. But it's interesting to speculate, and it is entirely possible that one alternative that never was a stronger opinion that would have been 5-3 instead of 7-1.
Okay, we've got one patient caller left with a question. Let's go to our final question.
Hi, this is George Lanoux. As you know, thank you for the very interesting discussion. As you know, I study disparity studies in the contracting field after Croson. And after Grotz and Grutter, I thought universities were going to have to do versions of disparity studies or diversity studies. And it looks to me like university councils told administrators, don't put anything on paper. If there is a serious diversity study done by any university, I'm not aware of it. Do you think that this decision will cause universities to actually study the impact of diversity on their campuses and produce documents roughly equivalent to the contracting disparity studies?
George, that's a good question. I think that what this is instructive of is you can't simply, I think I mentioned before, throw something on the wall and say, well, it's narrowly tailored. The court has said pretty clearly that the university is going to have to show, they must, the court, first of all, is going to have to verify that the means that you use is necessary to achieve the goal. But the university is going to have to show now that, look, this is something, we've considered other race-neutral alternatives. We're not simply going through the motions. If I were a plaintiff during the course of the discovery process, I'd be asking for all manner of things. To go to your original point, there, you know, they said don't commit anything to paper. Well, now I don't know that they've got that escape. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to have to show a good faith attempt to arrive at whatever program they've arrived at to achieve diversity. And if they don't have anything on paper, that begs the question as to whether or not they have looked for, as the court says, a workable race-neutral alternative. So that's going to be subject to scrutiny. And so I would think that if I'm a university, I marshal my resources, I get a contractor, I get a George Lanou or someone else to say, okay, here are all the things that we're going to assess. Here are the various programs available to us to achieve diversity as we've defined it. Now let's work through it and see whether or not we get to our critical mass. And one other thing, that exercise obviously leads a university to be very exposed. It creates a great deal of vulnerability because going back to what Larry said with respect to the University of Michigan, there was a lot of complete sham with respect to whether or not the University of Michigan was actually doing things in a race-neutral fashion at the law school level also.
Well, if I may make one comment, if universities are forced to produce these documents, then faculty and other public officials would have a chance to examine them, critique them, much as in the contracting disparity study field. And so the back and forth could be very useful as a tool to move universities toward true race neutrality. Because the one thing that I'm very much afraid of coming out of the Fisher decision is the enormous burden it places on plaintiffs. And if we can create these documents and thus force universities to behave more fairly before you actually have to sue them, then some good might be done.
We will let that be our final word. I want to thank, on behalf of the Federalist Society, Mr. Peter Kersenau and Professor Gail Harriott, especially for participating on such short notice. It's always good to have one of these calls as soon after decisions are issued as possible. So I thank you so much for your time and for your insights into this decision. To the audience, a reminder that tomorrow is the next decision day of the court. We don't know what to expect, but we will probably do something responsive in the form of a telephone conference call, hopefully tomorrow and later into the week. So please do check in at our website and monitor your emails for announcement on those calls. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.